calendar this morning with the case of Beazer Homes versus the District Court. This is case number 57187. Mr. Carlson, Mr. Mayfield, are you prepared to proceed?
Carlson, I have the Beazer Homes prepared, Your Honor.
Very well.
Mr. Mayfield? Mayfield, Dan Clifford, on behalf of the Association, Your Honor, we're ready to go.
Very well. Mr. Carlson.
Chief Justice and members of the court, may it please the court. First off, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure.
Secondly, I'd like to address the issues that the court has indicated were appropriate for discussion today, starting off with whether writ relief is appropriate, and I believe that that's fairly easily dealt with. The situation we're faced with is that the foundation for this lawsuit has been determined by the court, and the entire lawsuit rests upon it. If the court doesn't review it and say yes or no to this particular aspect of the court, we'll have done the entire trial and then have to go back and do it over again if the court finds that there is, in fact, no standing for these issues on behalf of the homeowners.
I think the court learned its lesson with Schutte, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll move on to the second item as to whether or not the issue of constitutional defect has been waived by the association for failing to bring it up in the lower court. I believe in this case that that is, in fact, the situation that the homeowner association has facing them. This court recently in Nye versus Washoe Medical Center said and has reaffirmed what has been said throughout a long time in this jurisdiction, that failure to raise an argument at the trial level precludes its being brought for the first time at the appellate level. As a result,
what do you do with their argument, though, that they're merely defending the correctness of a judgment or an order in this case in their favor, and therefore they're entitled to defend it on whatever basis is appropriate?
I believe that there's a situation where we haven't had an opportunity to provide a proper briefing for the court so as we can address these issues head on rather than having it was raised, as the court recalls, in the answer. Although the court was kind enough to grant us a brief reply, our reply was limited to the fact that we didn't believe that they had standing to raise those issues in this fashion. As the court's aware, this is one of, I believe, eight other writs pending, and those issues have been raised in those other cases, which may allow the court, if it wished to address it at that time. But right here, they're facing the issue that, in fact, they didn't raise it in the trial court and it hasn't been addressed. The trial court made no comment on it. And our reply is basically they don't have standing to bring it at this time. So that's the only response I have. The third issue, and I think the issue that's probably facing this court and ourselves, is whether the First Light decision was determined in error. And we believe that the First Light decision was not determined in error. And there seems to be a substantially different opinion as to what was granted by the trial court. My impression of the briefs provided by the Homeowners Association was that they believe that they were granted the right to have a class action on behalf of the homeowners, and that they are now the plaintiff in that class action. They're not suing in a representative action any longer, wherein the representative would bring an action on behalf of someone else to preserve their rights, and that individual would get the results of that litigation. We have here is an argument made by the association that they are now the plaintiff. They are the ones that will get the money. They are the only ones in a situation where they can, in fact, force repairs upon the homeowners. And that's an interesting situation because typically it appears that where you're suing on behalf of someone else to enforce their rights, that person, that entity, gets the results of that litigation. Here, the association is seizing the rights from the homeowners onto themselves, saying that they're in a superior position, that they are the ones and only the only ones who can effectuate these repairs. And those arguments are being made basically saying that they not only have standing to act on behalf of the individual homeowners, but they are in fact the only plaintiff that can come here. That presents problems for us in that we are now faced with two sets of individuals who can in fact sue for the same claim. As the court recalls from the briefs that were submitted in the underlying court, or the lower court, the plaintiffs say that they are only seeking damages for the building envelope, and that they are only seeking damages in a representative capacity. They have no ownership interest in the envelope. They tried to get around that by arguing to this court and the trial court that they are in a better position to enforce those rights. But they have no basis to enforce those rights other than the court, the legislature has granted them standing to bring cases on behalf of the homeowners. The problem with that, of course, is that they don't want to bring it on behalf of them. They want to keep the money and become the plaintiff.
Counsel, is that really a true statement, that it's only limited to on behalf of? Or is it a little more general in terms of the grant by the legislature?
The legislature said they could bring it in their own name and on behalf of the members of the association. In this case, though, they have no ownership interest, no maintenance obligation, and no other rights other than through the homeowners, because these homeowners actually control the exterior of their units. And although this is a townhouse project, and it, the homeowners association attempts to distinguish that from First Light by saying that case only dealt with the interior of the units, this is the same thing. They are as much a stranger to the exterior of this units as they were a stranger to the claims on the interior of the units.
I understand that, but I was just concerned with you kind of conflating the provisions under 116 versus the certification under 23.
Well, I believe that 116 allows them to bring an action where they have an interest independent of the homeowners, because their only interest in this case would be that they have no interest in the building envelope independent of the homeowners. They're having to bring their action on behalf of the homeowners to get in the door. They have no rights other than through the homeowners. And that's the situation we're faced here, because they have no ownership rights, no maintenance rights. In fact, they try to argue to the court and the lower court that their maintenance rights are if the buildings fall into such repair, they have a right but not an obligation to do repairs at that time. Their argument to this court is that because of their fiduciary obligations to the homeowners, they should be entrusted to make these repairs over the objection and without the concurrence of the homeowners. In addition to that, they don't in any way attempt to justify or to bring themselves within the Rule 23 analysis that this court recently, in 2009, determined was a requirement for them to bring these claims on behalf of the homeowners individually. What they've done, and the trial court has done, is basically say, we don't have to follow that precedent. We are not bound by that. The trial court, in her order, indicates that there is no reason for the association to bring themselves within the Rule 23 analysis, and no other association seems to be required to do that either, because NRS 116.3102 sub 1 sub D provides that they have standing, and this court's ruling that a Rule 23 analysis in light of the Schutte decision is required is inconsistent with that grant of standing. As a result of that, the trial court has basically rejected First Light and said that we don't have to go through that analysis.
How should we look at that to harmonize those two areas?
Well, when I was thinking about this, and we talked about it in some of our briefs, the issue seems to be that the association gets in the door by the grant of standing. They are now a member of a perhaps group of individuals or group of entities that can, in fact, bring a claim. In this case, they're bringing a claim not on their own behalf, because they have no rights on their own behalf, but through the rights of the Homeowners Association to protect the defendants from multiple claims, double recovery and things like that. This court has, I believe, correctly determined that the plaintiff homeowner association is acting instead of the class representative. And that class representative then has to demonstrate that it's an appropriate, that the litigation is appropriate for a class certification by going through all of the criteria necessary, including the one that this court talked about in Schutte, which is that it is a predominant claims that are being brought. And in the underlying, or in the trial court, they didn't do any of that. They came forward with very, very, very vague and broad claims that should have put the trial court on notice that they couldn't provide the information necessary to satisfy a Rule 23 analysis. And instead of requiring them either to do that or deny their request, the trial court then determined that a Rule 23 analysis was not required. I think this court has set up certain safeguards to prevent the defendants from facing double recovery, and also from some protection for the homeowners as to who is going to have these rights. Because right now we have a situation where The homeowner can sue on behalf of these claims, and now the homeowners' associations is they can also sue on behalf of these claims. If there's class action certified, then the defendants and the homeowners are at least know who obtains those rights. Right now, the argument seems to be from the homeowners' association that they have the rights. There is no divesting of the rights of the homeowners, and we are left with a potential, a substantial potential, of a double recovery imposed upon us. We also have the situation where if the homeowners' association chooses not to repair, to repair in a manner that's not acceptable to the homeowners, to determine that the timing of that repair is inappropriate, that the homeowner can then come in and sue us again while the other case is either pending or has been resolved. There is no protection for us if there is not a Rule 23 analysis or a finding.
Counsel, some of the issues you're raising now kind of skips us ahead in this, because by the same token I can ask, shouldn't the court have done a conditional order, a conditional order saying that we grant you Rule 23 conditionally this time to allow further discovery to deal with the issues that you're talking about while we're in this area? Or should they have just done the basic analysis as to whether or not the 116 verse 23 in which is applicable and how should they should have handled it?
Well, the motion was brought by the association for them to determine their standing. As a result of that, I think the court could have easily said, you have given insufficient information at this time for me to determine standing, and therefore your motion is denied without prejudice until such time as you can develop that. But the court decided not to do that. What the court said basically is, I don't believe that First Light applies to this situation, and I'm not going to make them go through the responsibility. This court asked that we talk about whether or not there is a satisfaction of the Rule 23 rule requirements just based upon the grant of the legislature of the one under 116. And we don't believe it is, because the, although the trial court made much of the issue that there's a grant of standing based upon two or more of the units, that isn't really an issue in this case, and it doesn't seem to preclude the court from determining that there is, in fact, a threshold which the numerosity standard can be moved down to allow a analysis for class action. One would say, though, that they're suing on behalf of two units, that perhaps it would be easier to have a joinder than it is to have a class action.
But, Mr. Carlson, doesn't First Light, in effect, say that the statute satisfies the numerosity requirement under Rule 23?
The First Light does indicate that there is a threshold number that the court can assume is true based upon the grant of statutory standing to the association.
So what First Light leaves remaining are the other elements of 23 that may be applicable, but numerosity is satisfied by the association through the statute.
I would agree with the court, and I think the court was very clear, especially in the sentence where this court, admonished the trial courts that they must determine, among other issues, which units have experienced constructional defects, the type of alleged defects, the compensation or the for the individual unit owners, and any damages necessary.
So you're not contesting the standing of the association to bring the case based upon the numerosity element of Rule 23?
We'd agree, Your Honor. We're not contesting that the numerosity is a preclusive element. However, we are contesting, and didn't in the trial court, is that they have not provided any of the information necessary to allow the court to do the required Rule 23 analysis. Basically, the trial court has said it's not necessary, and that seems to go directly against what this court has said, that it is necessary. And this court has provided that information and that safeguard so that we are not faced, as I said, with multiple claims. And also, one of the issues that First Light didn't mention, and has troubled me, is where does the money go if they are allowed to bring it on behalf of the homeowners of the homeowners? It appears that the homeowners association is saying the money goes to them, whereas these are individual rights that the CCNR make very clear. The only people who have the right to repair these units is the homeowners themselves.
But Mr. Carlson, if there were a class certified, the defendants wouldn't have any comment about where the money goes once paid to the class.
Wouldn't have a comment about where the money goes if it goes to the class.
And if the class receives the money, then under those circumstances, under Rule 23, the court and the plaintiffs and the representative decide where the money goes, right?
That's true, Your Honor. The determination of the distribution of the class proceeds would be based upon an approved order from the trial court and a determination among the class members as to where it goes.
Wasn't that the reason for the restatement comment that was referenced in First Light?
I believe that that's what's reflected in that comment. Yes, Your Honor. I wouldn't offer an opinion as to why that's in the opinion, but I do believe that that's reflected there. I guess our concern is that the process by which the association wishes to proceed doesn't seem to include what the court just described, which is a determination of the proceeds from this action among the class members. Because right now, what the argument has been, at least presented in the trial court, was that the association is the only one in the position to do the repairs. As a result of that, even though they have no ownership, no maintenance requirements, and even if the units fall into disrepair, have a right but not a duty to repair, under those circumstances, the obligation of the homeowners association to do anything with this money appears to be relatively tenuous.
Chief, may I ask another question?
Certainly, I'll provide additional time.
Mr. Carlson, is it your contention that the association can't prosecute a constructional defect claim that exists within the boundaries of these walls on behalf of an owner?
No, Your Honor. Our contention is that they can't seize the rights of the homeowners onto themselves.
But once the court certifies the class, it seems to me you don't have anything more to say because the principal objection you have, that you are protected against any subsequent or different claim, is over.
I agree, Your Honor, and that isn't seen to be the situation that's been presented to either the trial court or this court. The situation seems to be that they are seeking the money for their use, for their determination solely, and that they are the only party in this litigation who can make a determination as to time, scope, and whether a repair needs to be necessary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Mayfield.
Chief Justice Seda, Justices of the Court, I think much of that discussion is like putting the cart before the horse here, as it deals with a determination about what's going to happen after we determine how we're going to proceed with the association's lawsuit in this case. If when I was here last time arguing these issues, and the first Light 2 case was argued, I was arguing a case known as Monarch Estates. And in that case, this court decided that the association did have standing to pursue claims for masonry block walls that were owned entirely by the homeowners and were located entirely on their property, but in which the maintenance responsibility and cost was borne by 35 out of 84 homeowners. Ultimately, the court applied its understanding of First Light 2. It determined in this court and authored an opinion that the class would be certified for those 35 homes, and that the homeowners would, or the homeowners association, the board, would get the money and would make the necessary repairs to the block walls. And that is certainly is consistent with what we think of the responsibilities of homeowners associations. They are in place. They are ran by a board of directors that is elected by the members of the association. And really, their most significant, if not their sole purpose, is to protect and enhance the values of the association itself. And one of those purposes, of course, is protecting them from defects and the cost of repairing defects and the damage defects can do to property values, both, I submit, inside the units and outside the units on what we typically call here in Nevada the common elements. At the end of the argument last time, a question was posed to one of the lawyers on the plaintiff's side about whether or not principles of Rule 23 could be applied in situations involving NRS 116-3102-1D. And unfortunately, the answer was yes, that lawyer felt they could. I believe that misled the court in this case, that essentially Rule 23 application would be appropriate. We believe.
So are you asking us to overrule First Light 2?
What I'm saying, and I'll answer that question in more detail, it's your choice. Certainly in the past, when this court has recognized it has misapplied law or misunderstood the facts of a particular case or a case caused considerable confusion, the court has not hesitated to either withdraw the case or to take a new position to help the trial judges.
Right, I'm trying to understand your position, not our options. You're advocating that we either significantly modify First Light 2 or overrule it insofar as it suggests Rule 23 analysis is required when an association is asserting claims on behalf of individual homeowners affecting the common interest community, correct?
I am advocating that you either overrule First Light 2 because it violates NRS 2.120(2), and that is that a rule shall not abrogate or diminish the statute, or that you find in the alternative or together with it that using a rule, which is a judicially created vehicle, to violate a statute, which of course was passed by the legislature, both houses, and the governor in this state. And of course, the legislature has the plenary function to enact the laws, and the role of the court is ordinarily to interpret the statute in accordance with the intent of the legislature. You either overrule it because it violates separation of powers constitutionally, and or you decide to change or add additional comment concerning this court's interpretation of First Light 2 so that it will not be in discord with the statute and will not be a constitutional violation under Article 3, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution.
Would you, if you go to trial on this case as a representative without class certification and you lose, what is the state of the preclusive effect of that judgment vis-a-vis a homeowner who later tries to sue saying, my roof leaks and my outside walls are falling down, crumbling? Can that homeowner assert that claim, or is it precluded by the judgment that the homeowners association has attempted to get but lost?
I think as to issues that were actually litigated by the homeowners association pursuant to the statute on behalf of the individual members of the association, whether it be within their units or in the common elements, would be subject to issue preclusion or some other principle that would not permit them to pursue the lawsuit, and that the courts at the trial level and certainly at this level could enforce that.
What about claim preclusion?
I think you could claim preclusion and preclude those claims. And as between the homeowners and the association, we all know that the restatement, Section 611, said that as to internal matters, the defendants really don't have any say in that. For example, whether or not there's a vote to proceed with the lawsuit. And here in Nevada, we have a very significant number of statutes in NRS 116 that prescribe the duties and the obligations of the members to the association and of the association to the members. And they must get a vote before they can proceed with the litigation. And if somebody challenges the association's right, either under some statute or governing documents, to proceed, they can do so. And of course, that's an internal matter which the association and the members work out. And the restatement recognized that as between the association and the members, it is an internal matter, and the defendants don't have a say in it. So if the association didn't use the money, for instance, to make the necessary repairs, that would be a matter for the members of the association to take up with its board of directors. They could certainly withdraw them. They could elect a new board of directors. They could impeach them, et cetera, in order to see that the association is properly governed and the money is spent appropriately.
Counsel, before you proceed,
yes.
I'd like to go back to the your preamble to the question that was asked by Justice Pickering. This, what we are, you're asserting as a tension between 116 and 23, and the right under 116 to sue on behalf of the group. Why would we give the association more rights than we give the individuals in this particular, as to this issue? Why do they not like an individual or individuals have to meet the requirements of 23? Because you're just telling us, because the legislature gave them this basic right, they don't have to worry about that. But individuals coming together still would have to worry about this. Why would we give them more rights than we give individuals?
Because the legislature has determined by statute in adopting NRS 116-3102-1D that the association has that substantive right. And it's a substantive property right.
What is the specific right that it gives them except that they can sue as representatives on behalf? It doesn't specify how, whether it has to be an aggregate or whether it's a class.
Well, it gives them the standing to be the actual representative, and it takes care of, and it was adopted to take care of the problem in connection with the Deal case, where the Nevada Supreme Court determined that in the absence of statute, the association does not have standing to sue on behalf of the homeowners. Now, there are many different types of representative actions. A class action is one type. We have Nevada Revised Statute Section 17 that talks about standing can be conferred by legislation. In this state, we do not have any constitutional standing issues. We have issues that are either judicial standing issues that have been granted by case law or statutory standing that's been granted by statute. And that's what we're dealing with in this particular case. Where I think the court, after deciding correctly that the association did have standing, not only for claims in the common elements or the common area, but also for claims in the units, is when it next decided that procedurally we needed to apply the prerequisites of Rule 23. And the basis for that was taken from the Restatement Third, Property Servitudes, which happened to have been published in 1982, and a comment from that particular publication. That comment specifically stated in suits where no common property is involved, the association functions much like the plaintiff in class action litigation, and questions about the rights and duties between the association and the members with respect to the suit will normally be determined by the principles used in class action litigation. A couple of important things. It talks about where no common property is involved. I assume that the reporter of the restatement, Professor Susan French, meant common elements as we use it here, but it's not clear. I might add that the restatement does not model perfectly the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act from which the restatement 611 section was actually taken.
But doesn't the example that follows that comment involve a suit where you had certain claims that were purely association claims, and then others included in the same lawsuit that were purely homeowner claims, and so the association in that restatement hypothetical was asserting both its own claims and those of homeowners.
That's true, and in illustration one, that's the setting. It says that the association has standing to assert claims on behalf of the unit owners, but also in their individual units, but also on behalf of the association and the common property.
And didn't First Light follow that, First Light 2?
First Light followed that in this respect. It said that as to the common property, the association had standing. It said as to the units, the association also had standing under the statute NRS 116-3102. But with regard to the individual units that the courts should apply, as suggested by the comment, or this is paragraph 3 to section 611 of the restatement, should look to class action principles to see whether or not the association would be permitted to proceed as to the units only. I believe that First Light 2 is crystal clear as to the right of the association to pursue common elements and common areas. The problem arises in this case because the defendants are claiming, since the exterior walls and openings and roofs are owned in fee, as opposed to how they would be owned in a community, in a condominium community where we had a condominium as tenants in common, that we shouldn't be allowed to proceed, and they tack on to that, that we have, since we have no maintenance obligation, that's another reason why we shouldn't be allowed to proceed. We do have the right, as pointed out by counsel, to go in and make all the repairs and then assess all the homeowners for the repairs to the exterior of the townhomes in this case.
Now, counsel, yes. That's why I asked Mr. Carlson these questions. I don't hear him saying that. I thought I heard him say and conceded that the association has the ability to sue in a representative capacity for constructional defects, even if they're not on common property or owned by the association.
That's certainly not what his brief says. I think he kind of conceded that in the tail end of your questioning, Justice Hardesty, but that's not what the brief says. The brief says that as to these, and we're only pursuing here the exterior walls and roofs, we have to satisfy Rule 23 prerequisite test.
Could you indulge me, assuming for the moment that I treat his comment as a concession, what is wrong with the remaining portion of the Rule 23 analysis with respect to those claims where the association is suing in a representative capacity?
Well, the problem is this. Assuming for a second that, at least as to this case, numerosity is conceded. We have a case, not my law firm, but I reviewed all the cases that have been decided in a district court since First Light 2 came down. And there was a case recently decided in one of the courts where there were only, it was an association of 20 condominiums. And in that case, it was decided that the numerosity prerequisite of First Light 2 under a Rule 23 analysis was not met, and so the association was denied the right to go forward. In these cases, it could be argued that the association, since they own no property and they have no claim themselves in some instances, they cannot meet the typicality or the adequacy requirement of Rule 23. There's an interesting, if you look at one of the examples in the restatement, there is an example where...
We'll take your association as an example. If the statute satisfies numerosity, then isn't the examination of typicality, for example, whether the claims are typical among a certain number of members of the association, and that group is classified as a subclass, as discussed in Schutte?
I think you wouldn't have to classify it as a subclass if you find that that typicality is met by going through a Rule 23 analysis. Then I think the association could go forward in a representative capacity.
Well, if typicality is met, say for example, plaintiff is able to demonstrate by extrapolation that a particular defect exists in all 200 and some odd units. Typicality satisfied, is it not?
I wouldn't say a particular defect. I would say that a particular component, such as roofs, in all 131 buildings has defects. And so they're under the joint maintenance agreement of the two owners that is in the CCNRs. They would have the responsibility to fix that single roof, and I would say typicality is met because the conduct...
But isn't that what First Light asked the district court judges to analyze?
Yes, it does. What I'm saying is, if you look at the fact that the restatement was adopted in 2000, Our current NRS 116 section 3102 was adopted in 1991. There's no possible way, I don't believe, and certainly there's no indication that they did, that the legislature considered essentially grafting Rule 23 onto the statute that provided standing for the association. And if you actually look at Professor Susan French's notes, her comments, and her illustrations, it's pretty clear she didn't intend that either. She intended that we may look to some of the procedures, for example, on withdrawal or notice, or whether or not the individual homeowners could intervene into the action, just like they may intervene into a class action, that she looked at that, but that she didn't intend for Rule 23 in any particular iteration be grafted onto it. And a key is, if you look at the illustration, I believe it's number 3, it deals with an association bringing claims for earthquakes on behalf of the association and the common interest and common elements, but also on behalf of unit owners whose units were damaged in the earthquake. And it said that they, under 611 of the restatement, the association had the right to do that. And any matters as between the rights of the association, between it and its members and vice versa, would be decided from the normal procedures of the court. Well, we know from Schutte, where this court in footnote 70 cited Becerco, a California case, it was found that, you know, if there's earthquake damage to single-family homes, it's not appropriate, since the causation and the damage is different as to each home, and its location, for example, in relationship to, let's say, the epicenter of the earthquake, that class action are not appropriate. But here, the restatement reporter said, in that case, when you were suing the insurance company, you get money to make the necessary repairs, they could represent the individual homeowners. So it's very clear that the restatement, which came some 18 years after the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, recognized, as the drafters of that act did, that the association should have the right to pursue claims on behalf of its members, whether they're in individual units or not, without imposition of Rule 23.
Okay. Mr. Mayfield, as far as your survey of appellate cases on this issue, have any courts addressed this, whether the factors of Rule 23 should be considered as part of this process?
In connection with the motions that I've argued, it's about 15 now, and the work that we've done here in Monarch and in this case, we have not found a case where in the state the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act was adopted. It's only been adopted, I think, in 6 or 7 states, where they decided that Rule 23 should be reviewed prior to letting the representative under the statute proceed for either units or common elements. In fact, they address this issue, like Yacht Club 2, for instance, and decide exactly the opposite. You know, and it kind of runs afoul of NRS 116-1109, which directs the state to try and make the laws of this state uniform in comparison to the laws of other states that have adopted the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayfield. Mr. Carlson, I'm going to ask that we add another minute to Mr. Carlson's time, rebuttal time, in light of the questions that were asked at the end of his argument.
Thank you. Counsel didn't address the issue that none of this information was presented to the trial court, and I think that probably they've conceded that they didn't ask the trial court to do or provide the trial court sufficient information to allow them to reach a Rule 23 analysis. Most interesting part I thought of the discussion was when the Homeowners Association Council indicated that there would be a preclusive effect on any claim made by the Homeowners Association. I think there's substantial problems with that argument in that there doesn't seem to be any case law or statutory basis for saying that, and that's our concern. I think under the Rule 23 analysis, when a class action is certified, then you do have a basis to say you had your chance, you've been in the court, you're out of here. If, in fact, the case law is going to be that the only person who has standing now for construction defect claims is the Homeowners Association. That would, I would think, at least require the legislature to make some comment on that. They don't say that when they provide standing. They don't say you're the exclusive member. What they say is standing. The homeowners themselves have standing because they own these homes especially, in fee simple. They have a right. And what Mr. Mayfield is saying is that if the Homeowners Association sues on a, I guess, identical claim, then those rights are divested without notice, without any safeguards for the homeowners, and without any case law or statutory law that seems to say that a Homeowners Association suing is preclusive of the homeowners. That's also not our experience, so I know the court's not familiar with what is happening in the trial courts, but it doesn't seem to be also the experience in the trial courts that they are, in fact, precluded. As a result of that, I think that this court would be totally justified in enforcing the first light requirements in that it provides for who has the right standing. If they're going to have a class, then have a class. And everyone knows who has standing. Everybody knows who's going to get the money. Everybody knows that they're going to be precluded if they're unsuccessful. Because right
Mr.
now,
Carlson, what is your position with respect to Mr. Mayfield's suggestion that the first light decision is an aberration under UQA?
I think Mr. Mayfield was candid with the court that it hasn't really been discussed very much. It is a procedure that seems to be consistent with the idea of protection for both the homeowners and for the defendants. We are also unable to find any appellate decisions that have interpreted it the same way or have applied it. So,
are there cases out there, though, that reject application of Rule 23 to the counterpart of our 116 statute, other than the Yacht Club?
Other than the Yacht Club, we haven't really found any.
So Yacht Club is an intermediate Colorado case, and that's the only one out there addressing 23 and 116 other than First Light 2?
That's the only one we're aware of, Your Honor. So I think that we're getting back to the issue about what rights do they have, and those rights are
Mr. Carlson, if I could return to one of your arguments a moment ago. If the association sues and takes to trial its claims on a constructional defect and it fails, loses, why don't the elements of Five Star create claim or issue preclusion with respect to those claims against the homeowners who are not parties?
Well, we've actually argued that they do, Your Honor, and haven't been very successful with that, but I do believe that if the individual homeowners association has the right, the ability, and the desire to litigate those claims fully on behalf of the absent homeowners, that they should be precluded. I think that that's...
But one of the policies behind requiring a Rule 23 analysis is to assure the conclusion of the claim.
I think
if Five Star does that, then is the Rule 23 analysis necessary?
I think it's necessary because right now that no one really is applying the five-star analysis when there are subsequent claims. And we've been faced with that. They're not before the court. But there is, in fact, a much cleaner way to do it, and that would be what First Light has suggested. If you have a class action, then everyone knows what's going to happen. It also gives the homeowners an opportunity to make some kind of decision because there would, in fact, be notice. Right now, there's no provisions in here for notice to the homeowners as to what they want. And although the developer and others have been precluded from going into the internal...
Well, maybe, though, in the context of an association, those homeowners forfeited those rights when they became members of the association. If the association and Chapter 6, 116 gives the association the ability to sue in the representative capacity... That's what you get when you buy a place in an association.
I wouldn't think that that would be an interpretation that I would adopt under the fact that the particular CC&Rs here say that this particular aspect of their building is theirs alone. And they would be then without notice that they had no right to repair or refuse repair to their own home. What I was thinking about was, if I may, Your Honor, talk
please
for a little
proceed.
Longer. The analysis that the Homeowners Association is providing to you would apply equally to individual homes. if they were to say that we are in a better position, the homeowner association, to assert the rights of the individual homeowner because we can do it in a representative capacity, then in fact what you said is that the people who have the rights for single-family homes, condominiums, townhomes, are all resting with the homeowners association. And this court in Schutte rejected basically that no one has rights except the, or that the only people who have rights are some class that shouldn't have been certified. So I would, I respectfully think that saying that because you joined a homeowners association, you've lost all your rights to repair or determine the process of your own home wouldn't be something the court should adopt, and certainly not something that I would get from either the grant by the legislature or any case law.
I can ask a question.
Of course.
In the conclusion of Mr. Mayfield's presentation, he talked about the restatement versus the common interest community. What do you have in response to that, what he was asserting?
Well, I think this court has commented on the fact that the restatement seems to support the interpretation that was set forth in First Light when you commented and made this statement that in suits where no common property is involved, the association functions like a plaintiff in a class action litigation. That seems to be very consistent with what the restatement says and also consistent with the rights of the various parties. So I think Mr. Mayfield's conclusion is in error, that in fact the restatement goes contrary to what this court has determined in First Light. The process is harder for the plaintiff's association, but it's not insurmountable, and it protects the rights of all the various parties.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson, Mr. Mayfield, for your arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.